Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party. On today's show, we dust off our old VCR and press play on what Flickfeast called the horror film of the year, The Five-Star Censor. I'm your co-host, Dallas King, and regular listeners of the show will have heard me waxing lyrical about Censor ever since I was lucky enough to see it at Sundance earlier this year. But I'm excited that I'm finally able to talk about it with not only the rest of Team Filibuster, but we were also very lucky to speak with star Niamh Algar and co-writer and director Prano Bailey-Bond at Sundance London about the film. So before we hear what Team Filibuster thought about Censor, we're going to hear from Prano about the origins of Censor. Censor follows Enid, a film censor, set out to solve the mystery of her sister's disappearance, and after viewing a strangely familiar video nasty, she embarks on a quest that dissolves the lines between fiction and reality. So before we hear what Team Filibuster thought, let's hear from Prano Bailey-Bond about the origins of Censor.
I actually had the idea for Censor before making Nasty, so I was working on Censor. When I say working, I was, you know, writing the treatment for Censor, basically, with my co-writer, Anthony Fletcher. And then I, through the research, started to think about, you know, children during this period, because a lot of the concern around video nasties was around kids being able to get their hands on these films. And I thought it would be interesting to create a short that centred around a child. And that was where the idea for Nasty came from. And in my head, I was thinking, oh, well, I'll just submit this idea to the BFI and I'll get funding and then they'll fund the feature. And I submitted it and I didn't get the funding for the short from the BFI. But by the time I'd spent that long with the short, I was so in love with it that I wanted to make it anyway. And I saw it as a way to explore some of the techniques and narrative ideas in the feature, but almost in like a story that could be going on across town rather than a story that was like going to exactly speak to the feature. But there were elements of the narrative and the character journey, like the missing family member, that I felt really worked in Nasty, so I carried that through to Censor, and then lots of the techniques that I used in Censor I was exploring in the short. So it was a bit kind of like chicken and the egg in a way, like they both informed each other really, ultimately.
And now it's time to talk to Lee first up. He watched the film at Sundance London, and then somehow I managed to get him to go see a horror film twice. He caught up at Glasgow earlier this week, so I had a quick chat with him after the film. You have admitted on the podcast in the past that you are not really a horror person, you know, yet this is a horror film which you have seen twice before it's even out on release. So I'm guessing the fact that I've been hyping it up over the last, what is it now, 8 months, 7 months, 8 months, did it live up to your expectations?
Yeah, I suppose I will take issue with, I don't consider this a horror movie, and I kind of kept that in mind last time. Like, I look at this as sort of like a, you know, a psychological film that is about someone that works in the horror industry. You know, there are some horrific moments of violence, but I don't ever look at this and think, oh, it's a horror movie. It's just that someone that just happens to be their job. I don't consider it a horror movie. I think it's a beautiful tribute to, you know, the video nasties, the horrors of that period of time, without being that type of film itself. So, yeah, I don't consider it horror. Maybe that's kind of why I really like it. I just think of the, you know, the strength of the performances, you know, when I think of horror, I often just think of it's like shocks and, you know, surprises. And there's always often the horror film that kind of goes beyond things like that. But I just watched this and thought, nope, that is something pretty special. And it's, you know, it's a deep dive into British culture, you know, the attitudes at the time. It's a period piece that just happens to be about someone that works in that industry.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. It's definitely more on your psychological horror end of the spectrum rather than your, I say end of the spectrum, is probably, if we could probably look at it as a spectrum, which is a triangle where you've got psychological horror, you've got jump scare horror, and then you've got the potentially contentious elevated horror. or maybe a diamond with like just full bone gore and guts and stuff like that. So yeah, we'll have a diamond. So yeah, we're at the tip of the diamond here with the psychological horror. I mean, was that what you were expecting when you went in the first time? Because you saw it for the first time at Sundance London with an audience, to be fair, of press. I mean, was that what you were expecting going in, or were you expecting something a bit more sort of visceral? And
I'm not too sure what I expected. I think it was one of those ones. I think that there'd been so much buzz for a while, not just from yourself, but just sort of there'd been things online where it was like, oh, Censor sounds really good. And I think I was interested at the time because I found it thinking like, oh, I'm interested to see that kind of that world of the film Censor. I find that kind of topic and subject quite interesting. And I always think of sort of like, you know, I remembered, actually, I think we brought it up in the interview we had with Bailey Bond, where it was like, I think when I think of like video nasties, I think of Kim Newman's art part in Empire, or I think it was Empire, or where he would just sort of pick out these various video nasties through the 90s that he would recommend. And I just remembered reading them and just finding the concept really interesting. So when I saw his name in the opening credits, I was like, oh, that's a surprise. I wonder what his kind of involvement's going to be with this film. And yeah, I think when you sort of start getting those credits at the beginning as well, you were like, yeah, I don't know what I expected. You know, was it maybe going to be a horror? I didn't think so, but I thought it would probably be something quite intelligent and quite interesting. And I think when I watched those credits as it sort of set up 80s Britain, I thought, yep, I think I'm in good hands here. And it's probably my only real issue with the movie. And I remember turning to a friend of ours when I was watching it for the first time, when they show the old retro BFI Film 4 logos. I just wish the MGM one was one from the 80s
I had the exact same thought, actually, last night when we rewatched it in Glasgow, because I'm not sure if I'd actually seen it, because I'd seen it on, like, at Sundance, where there weren't really any credits at that point, and then sort of you through US iTunes, so I don't think it really had the MGM one on that one. So it was odd that they weren't able to use like one of the retro ones. Yeah, but yes, I mean, like you say, it's a minor sticking point.
I might have to address that. So years ago, I remember when Force Awakens came out, it was going to be weird without the 20th Century Fox logo. Mm-hmm. I am going to investigate what the MGM logo was in the 80s. And I will put together a little clip of, you know, with an MGM logo from the time appropriate period. I'm going to do my own little fan edit for the Censor opening titles. You've heard it here first.
Fantastic. I think it is pretty much exactly the same. It's just a little less polished and clearly more sort of filmed on 35mm than digital, I think. But it's still got the Roaring Lion. But yeah, other than that, it's fine. I mean, are you a fan of horror films which are about horror films, essentially? I mean, when I saw this in January for the first time, it's hard not to sort of think about something like, say, Barbarian Sound Studio, which again features a central character who's working on with horror films, but and then is potentially sort of driven mad by their involvement in stuff. It's like, I mean, obviously you've got sort of Scream style, you know, movies don't create psychos, they just make psychos more creative, or sort of Who Watches the Watchmen, you know, it's like they're watching these films to protect other people, but what happens to someone who's exposed to all that sort of stuff themselves? I mean, it does go into a lot of it. I mean, what did you make of Enid's sort of the main character's sort of descent into madness? And obviously we'll talk more with Kim about the ending of the film and what it potentially means, once you've given your opinion on what you did, I will ask you just a quick one word answer about a very specific question about the end.
Yeah, so I really like Neve Algar's like performance. I think it's genuinely incredible. It's one of those things, it's her eyes, it's what's going on in her face the whole time. Like, when I've watched this film two times, like, I've never once doubted the journey she goes on. Yes, she makes some little foolish decisions here and there, but I never watch that and go, nah, I don't agree with that. Like, I can feel the forces of nature from her past, from what's going on just now, and from the stress and mental health pressures that she's under, that what would drive her down this road. And it feels really tragic to watch. And like, I think it's a stunning performance that allows me to buy into that. That's something I often get with horror movies. Like, you know, whether it's a movie I love, like a Scream movie, or, you know, maybe one of the more schlocky ones, the characters often make stupid decisions to get from point A to point B. And while there is the odd leap here and there, it feels genuine. And I think that all goes down to Neve Algar's performance. Like, you see her at the beginning, she seems to have it, you know, relatively together, and it's just that dinner scene where it just completely all falls apart. And I could understand the, you know, I can't put myself in those shoes, but I could understand how someone having gone through that experience, that guilt, that, you know, repressed feelings that she's got, like, would explode in this kind of way and go on this journey. It's a stunning performance.
Yeah, no, she's utterly fantastic. And I think it's what, like you say, I mean, when you look at the videos and the films that she's watching, the performances are very sort of almost over the top and heightened and stuff like that. And I think what allows you to buy into her journey is the fact that it is so realistic. It just feels a very natural progression of where she is from the start of the film. Obviously, she goes to incredibly wild, dark places, but by the end of it, but it never feels or rings false at any point. And I think that's just a testament to not only her, but also the writing of the character. And then obviously having an assured director, like, even though it's her very first film, Prana Bailey-Bond has clearly worked a lot with the two of them together on building the character. And actually what we could do now is go to red carpet interviews that I was able to do with Neve and with Prano, and they talk about the working dynamic between the two of them together and the character of Enid.
Congratulations on the film. I loved your performance. It was absolutely fantastic. I mean, when approaching a role such as this, I mean, Prano really puts you through the ringer here. I was just wondering, did it affect you sort of going home? I'm just wondering, do you sort of self-censor films nowadays when you come off the set and you're like watching something at home, or you're sort of watching it and going, oh, I'd maybe cut that, or...
It's a really good point. Someone said that to me. It was like, now that when you go into acting, you're going to look at films differently. You'll never be able to look at them with like a non-objective eye. But no, I think, I don't know, I think that's the magic of storytelling, that allows you to be immersed, especially in a theatre. You forget how immersive an experience being in a cinema is. With the sound, aesthetically, I'm so excited to see a film, especially censored, that is was designed to be watched in a cinema. But yeah, she did. She put me through the ringer.
Yeah, and did you trust her all the way? I mean, yeah, her vision and stuff like that.
Yeah. We had like an amazing correspondence before we started filming, back and forth, just kind of tonally figuring out what it was that she wanted to accomplish, and just with the character. And so going into it, like, I couldn't have been more prepared. And also, like, you know, if you have a director that is emotionally in the scenes with you, like, literally she was going through all the emotions that I did, it just allows you to kind of commit to the moment even more so, because she understands emotionally how the character is in that moment.
How did you know
me
was going to be able to pull off transformative role as the movie comes along?
Yeah, I mean, when I was thinking about the character while I was writing, I was really thinking about who do I need, you know, to carry the film, because essentially this person is going to carry us through every single scene from beginning to end, and it's all about Enid. So I knew I had to find someone electric on screen who we wouldn't want to look away from. And when I saw Neve in The Virtues, that's how I felt when I saw her performing. But then I watched pretty much everything else she'd done, and I just saw how chameleon-like she is. And I'd already met her through the Screen International Stars of Tomorrow. But then when she came in to read, like, I knew how brilliant and lovely she was already, but when she came in to read, she just managed to kind of really encapsulate this kind of cocooned character at the front of the film, and this, like, nuance that we needed, because Enid's very closed. And then when we read the latter scenes, she just sort of blasted us into this kind of emotional stratosphere that I wasn't even expecting to go to. So I knew that, you know, not only did she have the kind of the talent and the skills to take us there, but also I really enjoyed communicating with her and I really enjoyed spending time with her, and I knew that this was somebody that I'd be able to kind of continue developing the character with. So yeah, I'm so lucky to have got the chance to work with her. I think she's going to be off to stardom next, I imagine.
So Lee, you know, Kim's going to be coming on in a minute, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to essentially censor you out for the rest of the episode. But to give me a one-word answer, was Enid responsible for her sister's disappearance?
No.
Interesting. We'll find out what Kim thinks later on in the episode. But thanks, Lee. And yes, I'm afraid I'm going to have to trim you out, but don't worry, I've only trimmed the smallest part of the genitals. So with Lee being edited out of the podcast quicker than a rape scene from The Last House on the Left, it is now time to welcome our very own video nasty girl, our scream queen. Welcome to our screening room, Kim Morrison. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good. So before we take a deep dive into some of the film's themes and plot developments, I mean, what were your initial thoughts and did I hype it up too much?
Yeah, this is one of those films that I think every single person that I knew that had seen it, apart from one, had loved it. So I went in with quite high expectations. I really enjoyed it. I feel like I maybe get a bit confused by endings that are a bit more ambiguous, so I maybe didn't enjoy the ending as much as some people, but it wasn't bad at all. I just was a bit like, huh, when it finished. But no, it was really good. It was really interesting, and it definitely makes me wish that I've now found like my ideal job was being like a censor for horror films, but like in the 80s, so you could go in a little screening room and type stuff on your typewriter. That is now like my career ambition, which I'll sadly never get because I'd have to invent a time machine at the same time.
I'm keen to get your thoughts actually on the video nasty era. Now I am a lot older than you, so I'm just wondering, I mean, growing up, had you heard much about it? I mean, when were you aware of these films, and what was the sort of first video nasty that you think you saw, and was it on VCR or was it on DVD?
So yeah, no, I remember hearing about it, probably not a lot of the more extreme ones and things, but I think the first one I probably saw that got banned and things was Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which really on the scale of those films is probably actually pretty tame. And I saw that for the first time actually on TV when they showed it on Channel 4 right after it had been like unbanned. It was the first time they were allowed to like legally show it, which I looked up for an article recently, which I think was in like 1999, which means I was 12. So, and I remember being like super excited to watch it on TV, and it's amazing. It's one of my favorite films. Everything else I maybe saw a bit later. When I was in university, I used to go out with a guy who worked in Blockbuster, so we used to rent a lot of stuff, and I remember renting things like Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes and things like that. I've probably still never seen a lot of the more extreme stuff because I'm not the biggest fan of gore because I just can't stomach it. So a lot of stuff like Driller Killer, which my boyfriend just watched recently, is probably a bit too graphic for me. But yeah, I think I used to work in HMV as well, so I used to see all the DVDs that were in those like yellow boxes and things that were the ones that used to be banned, and like now you could watch them and stuff, and they always just looked a bit more violent than I was a fan of. So I've probably not seen that many, but Texas Chainsaw was my first one.
I've actually got a bit of a funny story about that one. I remember being in holiday in Florida. I think it must have been 99 then, and there was like a video shop or sort of like entertainment shop that we went to, and it was clearly selling dodgy knockoff copies of films, and one of the films was Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I thought, oh wow, I've got to get a copy of this. I'm going to be like so cool because this is still banned in the UK. I'm going to be like, everyone's going to be like, oh my god, where'd you get a copy of this? And I'll be like, oh, I got it in America. And you know, it was like somehow like a region free VCR. I mean, it worked, but you know, I think I brought it back and then watched it, and like was really impressed with it. I know, like you say, it's not one of the more extreme in terms of gore and stuff like that. I think it's just the sheer relentlessness of the and the feeling of dread and stuff like that. It's more of like a mood of how it makes you feel and stuff like that. And there's another scene in that film which I will reference later on. But I think it was probably about a month after I came back. It was like the BBFC announced, hey, you know, we did The Exorcist a couple of years ago and now we're going to re-release Texas Chainsaw Massacre Uncut. And I was like, oh, suddenly my cheap knockoff version of a VCR doesn't seem so cool and fancy anymore. But yeah, I think it was like Exorcist was one of the first ones. I mean, I don't think it was ever officially on the Video Nasty list, that one, but it certainly was one that, you know, had a big thing about, oh, it's back in cinemas for the first time. And then I was like, not really that scary. But then again, I'm not particularly religious, so maybe just it wasn't for me. But I think it was, yeah, sort of uni was when I sort of got into horror properly, I think, yeah, with the sort of the Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2 and stuff like that. So yeah, but there's still a few that I haven't seen that I think are on the list. But I know there's is it Zombie 2? Is that the one with the, I mean, yeah, I think you must have it on one of your list articles about Igout, the one with the sort of splinter thing that goes into, is that one?
Yeah, there? I was going to say, yeah. I've never seen the film, but I have seen that scene in so many different things, and I'm just like, yeah.
It's top 100 deaths in horror movies, it's on Channel 4 or Channel 5 or something like that.
It's so grotesque, it's put me off seeing it. I'll need to like work up the courage one day to watch all the grosser ones.
Yeah, but obviously, so someone that when I was growing up, sort of reading about horror and stuff like that, particularly the Video Nasties, you know, the undisputed king was Kim Newman. And when we were at Sundance, we heard about how Kim became involved in the project.
One of the things I was curious about was sort of the relationship between sort of you and Kim Newman. I recognised his name when he popped up as a producer. I'm not a big horror person, but when I think of when I was younger, I just remember his like books and articles about Video Nasties, horrors, and he was so instrumental. What was that kind of relationship between you two like, and that sort of him as the producer and you as the director and co-writer? Yeah.
Well, he was an executive producer, so the producer was Helen Jones, but Kim is an old friend. I met him in 2010 because he selected one of my short films for a festival, and he's just been really supportive like throughout my short film, making them, and then when it came to Censor, he's basically the godfather of the Video Nasties. So when we started going out for funding, I was like, how would you feel about being an exec? And he just said yes, which was incredible. And then during the kind of process of writing the film, I'd send him the script every now and again and get his thoughts. And then a lot of what he was doing was saying, like, have you seen this film? Have you seen this film? And we talked quite a lot about Frederick North and about how there weren't that many British Video Nasty directors, because I think there's something a little bit racist in that, actually, in the UK, like being like, our films, our horror films are fine, but if they come from like Italy or somewhere else, then they're, you know, totally depraved. So there weren't a huge amount of British Video Nasty directors, but he'd kind of pointed me at Extro, which I think has like a British director, and then we talked a bit about Norman J. Warren and Pete Walker and some of the British directors, and then in the edit I'd show it to him and he'd normally say more blood or something like that. It's always like more gore.
So the fury around Video Nasties was born out of what was going on in society at the time and is a key aspect of the film. At Sundance, Prano spoke about how that backdrop helped to inform the character and the story as well.
This period and what was going on during this period was like so much of that is kind of what I wanted to like for Enid to embody in a way. I was kind of looking at, you know, what was going on during this period in terms of around the Video Nasties, and essentially you have like this, the birth of VHS, which led to this boom in low budget horror films being available, because previous to VHS they weren't getting cinema releases, you know, they weren't being classified, they were being rejected, and now they could go direct to the home. So you have this kind of period where the birth of VHS has kind of led to moral panic, or everybody going, what are these films going to do to society? They're going to corrupt and deprave our minds. And what I see during that period is I guess it makes me think about like how fragile we think we are, as you know, how fragile we think our moral compasses are, because throughout history we've seen periods where you know, we've become so afraid of what technology is going to do to us, and I guess I use that as an inspiration for the character and this idea of us doubting our morals, like wondering if deep down they're terrible people, and we're like one Lucio Fulci film away from like snapping and getting our shoelace out and grotting one another with our shoelaces or something. But I also, Enid was, you know, the idea of censorship in terms of like that informing the character. I really wanted to create a character who kind of embodied censorship, not just in terms of censorship of art, but also someone who was quite self-censored and had censored their traumatic memories. But then going back to the period and the kind of politics as well of this time, you've got kind of Thatcher's Britain and this very sort of oppressive world, you know, and you know, mines being closed down and like social welfare funding being cut for things. And what I see there is like a video Nazis becoming an easy kind of scapegoat. They're a very convenient scapegoat for all the bad things that are happening in the world that takes the pressure off the government, on off politicians, because you can just point the blame at film and say, well, all the terrible things are because of these movies existing. So I kind of was thinking a lot about the relationship between those things, and then building the world of the film was really like, I wanted it to be oppressive Thatcher's Britain. I didn't want it to be this kind of big shoulder pads, 80s, big earrings, big perms sort of world. So I was looking at like photography projects from the time, and one of them was Beyond Caring by Paul Graham, and he would go into dole offices and stuff and like photograph people kind of waiting, you know, waiting to go for their job centre meeting and things, and everybody's in like blues and greys and it's very kind of downbeat, and those were the kind of images I was referencing and showing my costume designer and my production designer, and kind of basing the palette of the real world of the film on, so that we've had this sort of oppressive 80s Britain rather than a kind of pop version of that.
And she also spoke about the challenges of recreating the period and shooting on film.
How much of it was a challenge? Like, you've really committed to the film, the analogue aspect, and clearly, like, the visuals, the special effects, makeup, how you've shot the film. How much of that was a challenge, and how do you almost budget for something like that? And back in the day, that was the cheap way to make films. Nowadays, it's so expensive in terms of stock. How difficult was that to pull off?
I mean, I had a really great team, and I was quite clear in terms of how I wanted to make the film from the start, and I think that helps a producer kind of work out what's important to you. So I was always very keen to shoot on 35mm, and I felt that that would be the format that would create the most authentic 80s look. You know, there's quite a few films that are kind of contemporary films made set in the 80s, and me and my DOP looked at them, and everything that we loved and felt was most authentic was shot on film. So we made lots of decisions early that were kind of very much looking towards like authenticity. But you're right, I mean, the amount of white noise I watched for this film for Nasty, and you get to the visual effects like, and you're going like, no, it's not quite real VHS. So what we ended up doing then was dubbing to VHS, because like, you know, I mean, it does degrade the image, so we had to mix the dubbed VHS image with you know, the kind of full res image in places to keep the quality. But I think essentially like things like that, thinking about like the VFX and also the sound design, because there as well we went to analog, we went to tape, and we used loads of really interesting kind of processing tools to kind of create crackly, weird sort of soundscapes. That's so much to do with the people that you're working with in those departments, the HODs, being as passionate about it being authentic and feeling unique as you are. So they were like really inspired by going there, and I was really excited by the ideas that they were coming up with and the techniques. So I think everybody just wanted to make it as good as possible. But yeah, it is a challenge because it's not a massive budget film, and when you're shooting something that's period, you can't just go like, oh, let's chuck that chair in or chuck that table in. You have to find exactly the right pen, and were these notepads invented in 1985, and everything's questioned. But then as a director, that almost gives you like an extra layer of being able to design everything, which I like. So yeah.
Thank you.
So Kim, what did you make of the look and the feel of the film and the setting in the 80s?
Yeah, I thought it looked really cool. I was trying to think. I watched something recently as well that was like set in the 80s or something. They'd filmed it to look, and this is a terrible story because I can't remember what the film is at all. But no, I thought it was really really cool. It was like a weird sort of, I guess, a very like British, like grey version of the 80s. I think when you see 80s stuff, usually it's really like super colourful and stuff. And it's, but this was all like more like grey and kind of office based and everything.
Yeah, I think she was keen to sort of go for sort of oppressive Thatcher's Britain rather than the sort of working girl sort of shoulder pad suits and all that.
Yeah,
stuff.
So it's still gave off the vibe with the big glasses and the chain, the glasses chain and stuff. But yeah, it was a bit different. I guess it kind of contrasts the actual films of the scenes of the films, I should say, which were all like purples and reds and stuff. Everything else was very grey. But no, it gave off that kind of retro-y feel without kind of shoving it down your throat like a lot of stuff does. So I thought it did it. I thought it handled it really well.
Yeah, and I mean, there was a sort of gradual sort of, as her mental state sort of unravels throughout the film. I think there is sort of like colours start to bleed through. I think there's one particular scene about halfway through where she sort of comes down from watching like the white noise on the VCR, and then the sort of like reds and purples and sort of a bit more sort of Lucio Fulci, Dario Argento colours start to bleed through until it all sort of combines it at the end. I mean, did you sort of like that sort of gradual and blending into the colour palette and stuff like that to slightly more familiar, I guess, horror sort of tropes and that?
Yeah,
stuff.
I think as well, because the rest of it was like so, I don't mean dull, but like a dull kind of colour palette, like grey and everything. I think it worked quite well, like stuff like Suspiria does, where the bright colours kind of edge it in, starts to make you feel quite like edgy without realising that it's happening. It just sort of seeps in and makes you feel quite uncomfortable, and you're like, oh man, something weird's going on here. And again, I think they did it really well without it being like super obvious and just getting shoved in your face. It was a very kind of subtle thing that you notice is happening, and you're like, oh, something's going on here in the background. It's a bit weird.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the interesting things about the film, and it might be sort of part of its inherent Britishness, is its use of humour. It can be a challenge, you know, to of how and when to use it. And so we asked Prano about how she managed to successfully achieve that balancing act in the film.
I love absurd humour, and I find life really absurd in general. And I think that when I first started to think about the censors and the video nasties, it felt like an amusing thing to me to think of like these highly educated people sitting around intellectualizing exploding heads and decapitations, and like you read through their notes and it is, you know, obviously it's a serious subject, but it is quite funny at the same time. So it always felt like it was like inherent in the subject and in just the setup of these characters. So I wanted Enid to have also this sort of dry sense of humour and these kind of quips that she'd come back with. For example, a lot of that's to do with the kind of, you know, the dog smart moments and the sort of the sexism and things like that. She uses humour slightly to kind of deflect things. But in terms of like getting that on screen, I was really blessed with an amazing cast and a lot of comedy legends such as Nicholas Burns, Michael Smiley, Felicity Montague, and you know, it's not a coincidence that I wanted to work with actors who are brilliant comedy actors as well, because I think comedy actors who can do straight drama are some of the best actors out there, and so they made it really easy for me, to be honest. It's like, I mean, Nick Burns is just funny, whatever. Like, I at one point I was like, how do you make everything you do so funny? He's like, maybe he didn't even mean for it, I don't know, but he's just such a funny man, and he's such a great actor as well. And I mean, that's the same for Michael and Felicity and loads of the other cast.
So what did you make of the use of the mixture of humour and horror, and what did you make of the supporting cast of, I mean, certainly anyone coming from it from a UK perspective will probably know most of the actors from sort of comedy series. So Nicholas Burns is from Nathan Barley, Felicity Montague's Lynn from Alan Partridge, and of course you've got the legend Michael Smiley from Spaced. I mean, what did you make of it with all these sort of random characters sort of popping up throughout the film and stuff?
Yeah, no, I thought it was good. Yeah, I didn't realise that the woman in the like kind of archives office was from Alan Partridge until like the second time she popped up, and then I was like, oh yeah, that's who that is. No, I thought it was good because I think it's probably like if you're working in a job like that where you're watching these horrible things every day, you probably would have to use humour as a coping mechanism to be like, oh, that bit where the person got their eyes gouged out or whatever. So I think it was kind of a good realistic representation of probably what they used to cope. I think Michael Smiley is always good for a bit of like weird humour when he pops up and stuff. I just watched A Field in England for the first time, which was a strange experience, and so he's kind of the same character at that, just a bit strange and a bit funny. So yeah, no, I thought it was good. Everything, just yeah, some of the lines that Enid came out with, like describing people getting brutally murdered, just quite matter of fact, like it was just part of her job. We're quite hilarious.
Yeah, I guess it's like you said at the beginning of the episode, it's such a bizarre and weird job, but also your dream job, that I guess, yeah, because we'll sort of talk about it later in the sort of a theme of like who watches The Watchmen. But yeah, if you didn't sort of treat it with a bit of humour and just took it also seriously, as Enid does from time to time, then yeah, I guess that's when there's the potential that things could go wrong. So we're now sort of going to dive into some of the big sort of topics and themes that I wanted to discuss, particularly with you, Kim, because you often write about horror, especially from a sort of female perspective and characters, etc. Now, something I was really intrigued by with this film, given that it is a film with a lot of female talent behind the camera, sort of producer, sort of director of photography, makeup, composer and stuff, they're all sort of females. And that was a sort of depiction of the treatment of women in not only the workplace, because obviously it's the 80s and there's a lot of sort of sexist banter in the office, but then also more specifically the treatment of actresses on set. So specifically, I asked Prano when we were down there about how, despite being a period film, it felt very timely due to the sort of Me Too movement, in between sort of like the sexual harassment at work and then also the sort of manipulation of women as well. So we got Prano's thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, when you look back at the video nasties, there's so much violence towards women in these films, and it wasn't the reason I wanted to make the film in the first place. I wasn't kind of setting up. I think there's a version of Censor that is very focused on violence towards women, and I was much more interested in, rather than a woman character going out to rescue women from violence, you know, but that being the kind of drive behind the character, I was much more interested in seeing a very complicated woman on screen who was dealing with her own demons, who perhaps felt that she was a bad person deep down, that she has something that she's trying to make up for, and it is in some ways a love story, and she is going out to kind of rescue her sister, so there's an element of that there, but it's slightly secondary to you know, the idea of somebody having this complicated kind of relationship with their own moral compass, which was kind of where I was coming from. But it is such a big factor when it comes to the video nasties that it felt like something that needed to be addressed. and there's a lot of sort of casual sexism, which to me is a normal thing that happens to women every day. So, you know, that's just part of being a woman in some ways. But what was it? You mentioning the Me Too movement is really interesting, because I wrote the scene with Doug Smart answering the door in his paisley dressing gown, and that was before the Weinstein sort of stories came out. And I remember hearing about him, you know, this whole dressing gown aspect of the Weinstein sort of saga, and thinking, oh, I wonder if people will think that I'm referencing that, but I'd actually already had him in a dressing gown. So just a small detail that I've always sort of thought interesting. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly something that I wanted to create a female character who maybe was different to the kinds of characters that I'd seen women playing before, or like at least rarely you see these kinds of very, very complicated, sort of slightly shady female characters.
And so during the Frederick North scene at the end, his emotional manipulation of Enid in order to try and provoke a certain, or what he thinks is a certain type of performance from her, it sort of reminded me of something that perhaps Marilyn Burns might have been forced to go through in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I'm thinking specifically of basically that last final sort of scene where she's basically spends about 20 minutes tied to a chair and being sort of, you know, just knowing what on earth is going on. It did seem like at times it maybe sort of took a wee bit, maybe pushed things too far, and her performance went from a performance to actually, am I actually going to get out of here? Is this a snuff film or something like that? So, I mean, what did you make of that sort of representation of the portrayal of women, especially how men are basically using and potentially abusing women on set to get for the purposes of art, I guess?
Yeah, I guess it definitely just all seemed about the reaction like that he wanted, as opposed to like what she was actually feeling, and the way that Michael Smiley's character as well spoke about the actress Alice Lee was a bit, it made her sound like very disposable as well, which I think is why Enid was quite worried about her. But I knew, I mean, I think it's right what you said. I mean, I've read Gunnar Hansen from Texas Chainsaw Massacre's like autobiography about the filming of Texas Chainsaw, and just how brutal it was for everyone involved, because they had no money, and Toby Hooper just made them do absolutely horrible things to try and get the shots. And I know I've heard things about like the way Alfred Hitchcock used to treat actresses in his films as well. It seems it's very much just like the way that they feel is like a sort of side effect of it, but as long as you get the shot, then that's what's important. And you definitely got hints of that, because without completely spoiling the ending as well, the director just kind of lets it go on with the stuff that's happening. He just sort of takes advantage of the way that Enid's feeling and lets it go on a lot longer than it probably should, probably because he's so wrapped up in probably how good it looks on film. So I don't think they seems to remotely care about the women that are in the film. And even like even Enid herself, like when they get hassle about letting this film kind of slip through the censor net, I mean, her male colleague sort of gets named, but all the harassment that you see is always directed at Enid. She's getting the phone calls, she's got the press outside, she's getting it looks like she's getting followed and photos taken of her and put in the paper and stuff. It seems to just all be thingied on her, because it's as if it was like, I don't know if it's because they think it was more her responsibility because she's a woman, she should have been looking after it better, or if they're just like disgusted that she's even involved in like the horror industry at all. But yeah, the women do seem to get a rougher treatment of things in the film.
Yeah, no, it's like, it's, I mean, she says at the start or something, I think it's to her mum, it's like she's doing it to protect people. So it's clear that she obviously feels that she's failed in that moment. But yeah, it's interesting that as with many, many jobs and workplaces, it's like if there's two people to blame and one's a man and one's a woman, it seems that the blame falls to the woman. And I mean, I'm not sure how much of it is down to the fact that in this particular case that Mary Whitehouse, the infamous Mary Whitehouse, who was sort of behind a lot of the campaign around video nasties and basically sort of censorship in general, basically a lot of people did not like her and what she was doing because, you know, everything, you know, free speech, freedom of expression and stuff like that, and who's to say, you know, what we can and can't watch. But then, you know, it's about gay, oh, but it's in the hands of children and stuff like that. And yeah, obviously, you know, there's then issues that, you know, can they tell the difference between fiction and reality? And sort of one thing that sort of ties into here, and obviously, you know, we'll sort of be going into spoilers from this point on, so if you have not seen Censor yet, then take a pause and come back. Okay, you've seen it, excellent. So obviously there's the moment with Frederick North at the end, and but before that there was the encounter with Doug Smart in his house, and they're probably the sort of two catalysts for her rather rapid descent. I mean, the film is only about 84 minutes, so it's, you know, it's a tightly knitted film, but she does sort of go off the deep end probably quite quickly in the end. But she seems, it's clear from the beginning that she's quite a wound, coiled spring, and it's not going to take much to push her over. And there's this aspect of sort of who watches the Watchmen, and where the, you know, the film censors are trying to make sure that these films don't corrupt young minds and stuff like that. So, but like you say, you know, what happens to someone who is exposed to these films day in, day out, constantly, you know, watching all this horrible stuff. But then on the alternative side, you know, there's that quote from Scream, you know, movies don't create psychos, they just make psychos more creative. So, you know, it's clear from the beginning that Enid is dealing with repressed memories regarding the disappearance of her sister from the start. And I'm keen to get your thoughts on what you thought of a niece performance as Enid, and was she a bad person? And did you believe her, the evolution of her character as she went across the film?
I mean, I thought she was amazing. She was a really interesting character to watch. Like I said, the way she sort of like deadpan delivered some lines that were really funny, but she didn't come across as that, I thought, were brilliant. I think her whole thing into madness was actually pretty believable, because it seemed as though, I mean, I'm not sure like what the age gap was between from when her sister went missing until now, or till the 80s, but she'd obviously been dealing with that for like a long time, and the fact that her parents had just seemed to like not get over it, but they'd seemed to try and do what they needed to do to try and like get past it, whereas she wasn't sort of willing to do that. And you sort of saw glimmers of that when she saw like the girl with the red hair in the tube station and stuff, but I think she was probably able to quite separate all the horrible stuff she was seeing at work from kind of rest of her life, like until it started to seem to like bleed together. And then I think she very quickly sort of embraced maybe all the stuff that she'd been repressing in her life as well about what could have happened to her sister. And she, because she was the only person that was there at the time, she feels this responsibility to like remember what happened. And then the way the film was kind of implying like maybe she had something to do with it, she can't really remember, maybe someone else was involved, maybe someone came and took her sister. And I think it's that the struggle to remember and the kind of weight of the fact that she's the only person left that seems to care about her sister, I think it all just rushed down on her at once, and she sort of found this lifeline of thinking her sister was that actress and just kind of like clenched onto it. So I do think the journey was believable. Like you said, it's a short film, it all happens quite quickly, but it doesn't kind of feel like rushed or out of place or anything. I think, like you said, when she goes to Doug's house and kind of gets a bit more information about the director and about the actress and the fact that he thinks they look like each other and things as well, it seems like that's enough to just shove it over the edge and just like go for it. But yeah, no, I thought she was fantastic, and definitely made like 80s grey office wear look amazing. Definitely a very iconic character, and I think like her finale look as well, like the hair and the dress and the blood was all very like older gothic horror. It just looked amazing. So yeah, I thought she was brilliant actress and character altogether.
Yeah, will you be getting a pair of those sort of big sort of
Enid Specs with the little chain to wear around your
neck.
For when you're watching your
movies. I was going to say, I do wear pretty ridiculously sized glasses as it is, but I am so blind that if I took mine off, I wouldn't be able to see anything. So and if I had the chain, it would just be for show. I wouldn't actually be able to ever remove my glasses.
Well, I've seen the film several times, so I actually can remember that looking at the death certificate, it was I think it was 1965, and the Video Recordings Act came in 1984, so we're probably looking at like about 20 years that they would have been living with this, and I guess it's understandable that they would want to move on at that time, but obviously if someone was directly involved in some way, then they would have a tougher time dealing with that, so... This is your final spoiler warning. Go and see Sandra and then come back because things are going to get serious now. So obviously, you know, you mentioned at the top of the episode, one of the issues you had with the film was the ambiguity around the ending, which is actually one of the main things which I actually really love about it. But hand on your heart, I've already asked Lee this. I'm going to ask you, did Enid kill her sister?
I thought that maybe she had, and this was what my boyfriend thought watching it as well, that maybe at the end when you see her like taking her sister home to her parents and there's the sort of weird flashes of like the sister, or the, I'm going to sister inverted commas, like crying for help and the parents crying and stuff. I thought that maybe she had just like forcibly like kidnapped her or something and dragged her back to the house and was just putting her and their parents through all this weird trauma. She'd killed a couple of people by this point, so it's like, why wouldn't she have? But I feel like, yeah, I don't know.
I'm thinking more specifically like her actual sister, yeah, when she was young. Yeah, do you think that she did?
I don't know, because I feel like the film was sort of making you think that a little bit, but maybe not pushing it enough to make you think that she necessarily had. I think she seemed so, I guess, coherent and stuff at the beginning, that the fact that she was still, I know there was like loads of sort of elements of talking about how there was like this amnesia killer who couldn't remember having done it and stuff, but I feel like I don't think she did. I think she just, it was genuinely like the guilt of not being able to remember what happened that sort of twisted her brain a bit, and that was why she was trying to find like a solution. But I just don't see I guess you don't see a lot of her actual childhood. You sort of seen the bits from the Don't Go in the Church film, so it's hard to judge, but it just doesn't seem like it would be in her character to have done that. But I'm not sure.
Okay, that's interesting, because yeah, Lee was a no as well, so that's two no's. I am at the moment 100% yes, she did it. And I developed a rather robust theory about potentially what it all means, and I presented it to Prano at Sundance, probably looking like Charlie Day, and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, with this big board behind him, looking really mad about it. But let's hear what she made of my rather outlandish theory.
I apologise now in advance, because this is going to be quite a nerdy question.
Okay.
But you're talking there about how with VHS and whatever people, it was like, as the table was, they could re-watch them over and over again.
Yeah.
Now, I've watched the film several times now, and I've gone down a bit of a rabbit hole with the final shot of like the censor video coming up.
Yeah.
And I was like, what does that mean? And I could be completely off base here. But I was wondering if the whole sort of scenario was created by Enid, and she's actually in a mental asylum, because there's several sort of things, like her name is an anagram of Biden sane to remain insane. The film titles, like, you've got that amnesiac killer and asunder, which means to separate. To, she's separated from her sister, also temporarily separated from reality. And, you know, the visual style sort of change as, you know, she progresses more and more into her sort of imagination. And then there's the video case that she sees in the video shop, which is like the day the world began. Yeah. It's like, is that actually referring to potentially the day that she maybe killed her own sister? And she's now creating this whole thing as a way to cope with that, as in order to try and protect herself from what she's now trying to. She's created a character who protects others from it. Am I completely off base?
You weren't kidding when you said you went down the rabbit hole.
I love that you've come up with all of this stuff. It's amazing. I think that you should write Sansa too. Some of those ideas are new to me, so like they're not necessarily exactly what I was thinking, but I don't, like, the film has got ambiguous aspects, and that is because I want people to bring their own interpretations to it, and I want people to talk about it afterwards and have their own feelings and opinions about what. I think things live on as well in your mind sometimes when there's like a thread left unsewn, and there are reasons why things are ambiguous in the film, and a lot of that's to do with the answers that we don't have in real life. You know, if we don't have the answer in real life, then I didn't want to answer that in the film. I wanted to make it kind of, especially for Enid's experience, like I wanted it to be in her point of view, and she doesn't have all the answers by the end of the film. But I love the rabbit hole you've been down, and I fully, you know, support your pitching on Sansa too, to do something crazy with that. There are things that I think even I feel conflicted about when it comes to the video nasties themselves. Like, I think, you know, there's violence towards animals in films like Cannibal Holocaust that I really struggle with, and obviously those filmmakers were prosecuted, and there is a lot of violence towards women that can feel gratuitous. And so I think the thing is, censorship's changed now, it's classification, and so there's classification now in place so that people can be aware of what kids are or aren't going to watch. When I was a kid, I watched loads of things I was far too young to watch, and I think I turned out okay. So it's all down to the individual, isn't it? And like, you knowing what your threshold is, and I think when you're a kid, you want to push that threshold and find out what your threshold is, but also you're being egged on by your friends. And there's a really interesting story from the 80s. They've done like it was like a news headline saying like 6 in 8, or like 8 in 10 7-year-olds have watched a video nasty or something like that. So a bunch of like pro video nasty people went out with a load of fake video nasty titles, and they went around schools and did like asked kids like, so have you seen this completely made up horror film? And they were like, yeah, I've seen it. Because they didn't want to look like they hadn't seen it in front of their mates. So it totally undermined this statistic, because you can't trust that kids are gonna tell the truth about those things. So I think the whole thing around kids is a really interesting one to explore. But the shadow self was something, I mean, for me, horror is about the return of the repressed. It's the thing, and that's very much there in Sansa, and I think in a lot of my short films, like over time, I realised that I was really obsessed with characters who are repressed, who don't want to face some aspect of themselves, who think that there's a part of themselves that's unacceptable or, wrong or sinful in some way, and that they're trying to, you know, reject that side of themselves, and basically through rejecting it, that's just growing stronger and stronger, and eventually it's going to kind of seep out through the cracks in a more and more twisted way because you're fighting it. And so I think, like, you know, that's sort of what I was exploring a lot in Enid, and in this idea of censorship and censoring an aspect of yourself or your past or your memory, and then that kind of creeping up on you and getting you. And me and my sound designer talked a lot about the shadow self in relation to that. you know, that maybe we all have a shadow self. I mean, me and my co-writer Anthony were always talking about how everybody has aspects of themselves that they self-censor. And I think more and more on social media, we sort of, it's become like a normal part of everyday life, like what we show other people about ourselves and our lives, and what we don't show other people about ourselves and our lives. And that's all kind of entangled in the shadow self. But my sound designer got so into it that he started talking about how he wanted to make a sound for the shadow self in for every element of the film. So at one point we actually had a conversation about Enid's fridge's shadow self and what sound that would be, which always made me kind of laugh, because it's such a sound design thing to think about.
So Sensor 2 is on the way. That's an exclusive, folks. We're going to work on Sensor 2. So let me see, where do I start with the theory? I'm going to present it to you, and then you can let me know if I convinced you about where I'm coming from. So basically, I started going down this rabbit hole because of the final shot, where it's sort of, you've got that bit where she sort of takes the sister back, and, you know, apparently all crime is now over because video nasties are gone, which is what, you know, the media seem to think, and of course that was never going to happen. And interestingly, the backdrop of the house where the family are reunited is the same as the front cover of The Day the World Began, the video in the video shop, and I theorize that is the day that she had her mental break after killing her sister. And that she has created a world in her own mind where she is a film censor, because she was corrupted by video nasties herself at a young age, killed her sister because she saw something on the video, and is now in her mind trying to save other people from it to atone for what she did. She's created this perfect illusion for herself, but there are two events that shatter that illusion and begin the descent into madness. So one is the amnesiac killer, which is when she's summoned to the boss's office to be told a man murdered his wife and children, and the press will link it to a film that she passed called Deranged. Deranged, obviously, meaning mad. So this could be reality bleeding into fantasy, and that she is the real amnesiac killer, and that she murdered her sister but has been unable to remember and locked away in a mental asylum. And in her mind, she's given the unspeakable act to another person as a way of coping with the guilt. So central to this theory in the conversation is Enid having a chat with her fellow censor Perkins, who said, when she asked him how could he not remember what he did, well, it could be basic trauma. You'd be surprised what the human brain can edit out when it can't handle the truth. So unable to cope with what she did, she edited out the memory of her sister's murder by her own hand, creating the new reality in place, one where she is the hero and not the villain. Point two, don't go in the church. At the behest of producer Doug Smart, Enid is assigned to watch the new Frederick North film. The film features two young girls in the woods, with the older one forcing the younger one into a creepy-looking cabin before killing her with an axe. Seeing this triggers a memory seemingly in Enid's past, reality is threatening to bleed into the fantasy. Now, why do people go to church? To confess, to repent their sins. So by not going to church, Enid is able to avoid confronting the truth. So when she watches the film, she's forced to confront her past, the murder, and the disappearance of her sister. It awakens more memories and then provokes a physical reaction in her, i.e. the vomiting afterwards. So from that point on, Enid becomes increasingly mentally unstable and also appears uncomfortable in her own skin. Not only does she physically adjust her posture on several occasions, but she's seen picking at the fingers on her skin on her fingers from now on, at increasing regularity. So many of the film titles mentioned in Censor relate to Enid's deteriorating mental state. So Extreme Coda, Coda can refer to the final part of an event, and Extreme Coda is the foreshadowing of the film's final act, where it rapidly descends into madness and violence. So you've got Deranged, the film that supposedly inspired the amnesiac killer, is another hint in his state of mind. The one where she finds the Alice Lee, that's called Asunder, and the definition is apart from each other, i.e. to separate. Enid is separated from her sister, but also separated from reality in her mind. And then they've got The Day the World Began, which is the one that I mentioned earlier about how it sort of mirrors the ending of the film. So by the final act of the film, Enid is unable and unwilling to accept reality. Anyone who threatens her version of that reality is removed, which is why she kills Doug Smart and Frederick North, because they were the ones forcing her to confront her reality. And then when the actress Alice Lee doesn't play her part in her fiction and confirm that she is Nina, Enid weeps on the floor repeating, "You have to be her, you have to be her," before using the remote control to basically play a new ending of her film. And then this is the ending, this is which is doomed to repeat herself. But the biggest hint for me is the fact that the protagonist's name is Enid Baines, which translates to bide insane, i.e. to remain insane. So she is trapped being insane, and it's just, it's, you know, she's on an endless loop now on this VCR. It'll be rewound and played again and again because she's unable to confront her terrible reality. And end scene. So have I done enough to convince you or to make you watch the film again and go, huh?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know what? It's definitely one that I would probably have to watch again, because I think if you go into it, as you obviously do with most films on the first watch, just thinking it's going to be like a regular horror film, and then you discover there's more stuff going on, it would make more sense to watch it. I think the bit where you said with the guy being like, oh, you can be surprised what the brain can edit out, I maybe just thought there were so many hints sort of right at the beginning that implied that she'd maybe killed her sister, that I was like, this can't be the end. And I mean, it wasn't really the ending because she went through all this other stuff, but I think I was just like, well, it can't be, because that's just seems a bit obvious. But it obviously took a very different journey rather than just revealing that she had done it at the end. So yeah, I'm not sure. That does sound at all makes sense. I did notice the video, the happy sunny daisy video cover in the video shop, I did notice that at the end, that it did seem very similar. But yeah, no, I would definitely like to, I mean, you've obviously seen it a few times, so you'll have it a lot more wedged in me, but that makes sense. And I think if I went into it again sort of looking for the more different layers on it, then maybe I would feel more satisfied by the ending, because I think I just always want an ending that makes complete sense and everything's kind of wrapped up. So yeah, it does make sense.
yeah, no, I mean, basically it's one of these things where basically if you put enough time and overanalyze stuff, you can make an argument. But you know, Plano herself said that, you know, it wasn't, She had not considered that theory before, but it was a new one on her, but she appreciated it. But she'd always planned for it to be slightly ambiguous in the fact that for her, Enid does not know the answer herself. So she cannot. So because the film's basically presented from her point of view, I mean, she's in every single scene. If she doesn't know the answer, then neither can the audience, because, you know, that she can't draw that out of her mind. I mean, clearly she must have been trying this sort of like journals that she's been writing. She seems obsessed with puzzles as well. There's like crossword puzzles and puzzle books. Even then, you know, next time I'll probably be trying to pause on those and trying to read every word to try and figure out if there's a clue in there or something like that, to try and figure out what's going on, and spend too much time getting obsessed and then go mad myself. But yeah, I think it's that kind of film that she wants people to leave the cinema still thinking about it. You know, there's the short, sharp shock, you know, jump scare style horror films, which are like, oh, they're great to watch, they give you a visceral thrill, but then maybe they don't stay with you. I mean, everyone I've spoken to has sort of been talking about Sensor later on, and it's the kind of film that will stick with you. And like you say, you can go down a rabbit hole theorizing about all the different things about what it means. And it's also an interesting sort of depiction of, you know, a very specific time in British culture with the video nasties as well. And I mean, where do you stand on films about films? Because I mean, obviously the first film that I thought of when watching this was potentially something like Barbarian Sound Studio, which features another sort of protagonist who's working on a movie and basically goes potentially mad watching it. You've got like Blowout as well, which features a sound recordist working on a horror film and stuff like that. So I mean, where do you stand on horror films about horror films?
Yeah, I was trying to think of examples there, and literally the only one I could think of was the second Urban Legend film, which is probably not the best example. But also...
Well, I guess we'd have Scream 2 with Stab.
Yeah,
and,
that's true. No, I think it's a good... I think it's a good, like, kind of meta layer to it. It's good to acknowledge the sort of, I guess, significance that horror films have in culture and the, I guess, the discussion around the fact of whether they think they make people more dangerous, or the people who are involved in them can go a bit like weird when they're making them as well. I think it's a good sort of dive into like the whole thing of like what does and I say this as the biggest horror fan ever, but what does someone's brain have to be like to either enjoy making these films or enjoy watching them? I think it's a good kind of topic to make films about. So yeah, no, I'm all for it. It's always nice to kind of see horror geeky characters on the screen, and it's nice to get I don't know how much Enid flat out enjoyed watching the horror films, but it's nice to get sort of a horror geeky woman on a film rather than it just always being like Randy from Scream type people, as much as I love them. Yeah, it's nice to get a woman doing it for a change, so I'll go for that. And yeah, it's cool, like you said, like to get that kind of chunk of representation of what it was like, because they said a thing in the film which I'd never really thought about before. I always kind of wondered how the Video Nasty thing came about, and it was the whole point of like the fact that stuff was getting released on VHS so kids could just sit and watch it over and over and over again if they wanted, which I guess I'd never really thought about. I was like, why has it suddenly become such a big thing? But then that makes sense, because obviously if stuff was on TV you'd maybe see it once and that would be it, it would be gone for like a few years until it came back around again, so it kind of made a bit more sense. I don't agree with it at all, but it still made a bit more sense as to why they would suddenly crack down on all this stuff. But yeah, no, I think it's an interesting sort of look into that chunk of the horror history, and then also make it its own horror story at the same time.
Yeah, and has it inspired you to start working your way through the official Video Nasty list, all the officially banned titles and stuff like that, or are they still all a bit too practically gory and stuff, even for you, even though it's probably just melted Crayola crayons and stuff? So,
you know what, I'd be interested to see what's actually kind of on it that isn't the ones I have already seen, because some of them, like things like The Hills Have Eyes and like Texas Chainsaw, is not very actually violent, like gorily violent at all. I'd be interested to see how many are on it that I think I could actually handle. But yeah, there's probably some. I think it's sometimes it's the effects that look worse. Don't necessarily look like real blood and stuff. They look a bit like just gloopy and gross. That actually comes off worse for me. I think even though I know it doesn't look real, it just looks so much more disgusting than like actual blood. It's sometimes worse. So yeah, I know, I'd be interested to see how many I thought I could deal with, and also if they're even easy to get access to still.
Yeah, no, I think most of them have now in one way or another been released, but yeah, no, that's I guess that's another podcast. I'm not sure if we'll get Lee on that one, because I think it might be too strong for his stomach. But yeah, in the meantime, Censor is out now in cinemas. Visit censorfilm.co.uk to find out screenings near you, and let us know what you thought about the film and horror in general. And yeah, we'll speak to you soon. Bye bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.